This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, that's not equality, when sexism dresses up as feminism in speculative fiction.
Okay, so let's just get it out there right now that this week is a response to Sarah J. Maas's latest novel, A Court of Silver Flames.
Yeah, to be fair, there's definitely been a lot of things that I personally have read recently, some of which is recent, some of which is not recently released, but I just happened to have picked it up recently. And it's kind of all piled together. So it's been quite an accumulative effect for me.
Yeah, I think it's definitely been an accumulative one. But I think this was the book that the straw that broke the camel's back, as
yeah, the dromedary did not like that particular 700-page tome. On the other hand, I do honestly not want to spend like the entire episode, me personally, this is not Madeleine, just slagging off one author, because it's not really like that. And to be fair, she's produced books in the past which I've really enjoyed. I mean, I even enjoyed Crescent City.
I think it's important to say that yes, this episode for me, because I think both of us were thinking about it, and then I said, why don't we do an episode about this, and Jules immediately went, yes!
My time has gone. I've been preparing for this all my life.
And it was in response to A Court of Silver Flames. So if you haven't read that yet, you might not want to listen to this episode. At the same time, I also think it's really important to say that Jules didn't enjoy this book. I did. I did actually enjoy it, and I can measure the fact that I enjoyed it because I did finish it, and I finished it in a couple of days, which, considering it is a very thick, you know, tome, and that I was also doing lots of other things at the same time, you know, I have to say I did enjoy it. I got something out of it. I also found some areas to be very worrying, very problematic, particularly because it had been labelled as being very feminist, and it didn't read as feminist to me. To the contrary, it felt very backward in some respects. And again, that doesn't mean that you can't enjoy it, and there are lots and lots of people who've absolutely loved it, so this is not us saying you're not allowed to enjoy this book. This is just us picking up on some of the things which are present in A Court of Silver Flames and in other books which have been labelled as feminist, which we would argue are not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we also have to make the distinction whether the author themselves considers themselves to be feminist, or whether people read the book and go, oh my god, this is just so feminist, it's brilliant, and it has nothing to do with the author at all.
Yeah.
And I think actually it's a little bit of both with Sarah J. Maas, because she's made several statements online talking about feminism, and I have to say, what I've read, and obviously I don't know her in person, and everything I've heard suggests that she's a really nice, sweet person when you're face to face with her, but some of the things she's actually said have been along the lines of very waspish, in the sense of white Anglo-Saxon Protestant type of feminism.
Yeah.
And, you know, okay, that, you know, the whole process of writing a book can be about challenging your values and getting past things that have been internalised. But at the stage we're at the moment, we are at the stage of this is wasp feminism, if it's feminism at all.
Yeah.
In my opinion. So there's that.
Yes.
Yeah, and obviously loads of people have jumped on her books and said they're really feminist, etc. I always found it kind of a bit insulting when people were saying, thank you for giving us characters who have periods and who enjoy sex, etc. And I'm like, you realise Tamora Pierce was doing this and doing it better and more equally without cutting men out of the equation completely, sort of 20 years ago, like 20 years before Sarah J. Maas produced the Assassin books.
Yeah.
So it's that's a, you know, whatever age you're at when you discover certain books, guess what? Someone has already got there.
Yeah. Again, it's fair enough. So I think, you know, even if one person was already doing it, it's great that Sarah J. Maas was also doing it. But we'll get into kind of the nitty-gritty of that and what we mean by feminism, because it's also really important to recognise that feminism is a word that has changed, and it's also a word that has a lot of meanings to different people. So I think before we start, it's really important that Jules and I define what we specifically mean when we use the word feminism.
Yeah, and specifically in the context of this episode, because in some respects it's not a word I'm massively attached to. I'm far more interested in a genuine equality of rights, a genuine egalitarianism between all people regardless of any gender, yeah, or sexual orientation or what have you. And I sometimes feel that from where feminism has originated and gone to, it can leave certain groups of people behind. Mm-hmm. The same with any organisation. This is not just a pop-up at third wave feminism. this is a case of, you know what, it depends. People will take on something and say that's their cause, and then things get permuted and they change and people get forgotten and they get cut out. Which, you know, is a real shame. Nothing is perfect. No organisation is perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. And no organisation is perfect also because it's not one.
Yeah, absolutely. When you've got anything that is decentralised, you don't have a clear voice acting as the figurehead or the leader.
Yeah.
And I can see why people choose not to do that. But at the same time, when you do that, that means there are many, many factions and it will fracture.
Yeah. So it's how you get TERFs, for example.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. And whether or not some of what they personally think is an opinion they're entitled to is, you know, not something we're going to get into today.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's beyond the scope of this episode. But there are people, obviously, who still get left behind. For one thing, feminism should be about equal rights for everybody, so that includes men.
Yeah, and
so if your brand of feminism is about grinding men down because it's time for women to be on top, then you and I do not share the same ideology.
No, I completely agree. Feminism is for everybody, which, as Jules says, includes men, includes straight, cis, white men. It's for everybody.
Yeah.
It's
they're not the enemy. Just because the world is set up for them, yeah, doesn't mean they're the enemy.
It's for me, the way I've always seen feminism is that it's basically about saying everything should be judged on the individual. There should be no preconceptions based on gender or the average. And the average, that's really important. The way I always saw it was, you could say, arguably, that the strongest man in the world is going to be stronger than the strongest woman in the world. But then, of course, that, you know, the moment you start bringing trans people into the equation, how do you then start to equate strongest man, strongest woman? Are we going to be very binary about this? Why does it only have to be these two genders, etc.? But if we just look at it at that very basic form, strongest man, strongest woman, you would then say, okay, but the strongest woman is going to still be stronger than the average man.
Well, absolutely, and you wouldn't even need it to be the strongest woman.
No.
And then, again, you're looking at different types of strength, and it, as if strength is a quantitative thing,
yeah,
that means that that is the thing to which you attribute the most value, which is obviously a nonsensical argument.
Yeah.
So at that point, we can throw that out the window entirely, yeah, can't we?
There's a great... I was reading about this great book, which was written... It was about 100 years ago by a Bengali author whose name has just gone out of my head, but it's called Sultana's Dream. And in it, there's this utopia, which is called Ladyland. It's very tongue-in-cheek, and it's a utopia because there are no men there. And so, like, the working week has gone, you know, has been greatly reduced to basically 2 hours a day, because they say, well, now the men aren't here, they're not wasting 6 hours a day smoking, so we get a lot done a lot faster. And, you know, it's very tongue-in-cheek. Again, it was written 100 years ago. But one of the things I really like about it is that they have this argument against this perceived superiority of men by saying men are stronger than women and men have bigger brains than women. And they turn around and they say an elephant has a bigger brain than a man and a tiger is stronger than a man, but we don't let them rule society. We don't perceive them as being better. Size and strength mean nothing, really, do they? In terms of how human societies work. So I did laugh when I read that. I was like, it's a good point.
I mean, minor thing of pedantry at the obviously, I'm guessing the author had never actually seen an elephant brain because they're actually smaller than the human brain.
Yeah, okay, all right. But... you know what I mean. Again, 100 years ago, so...
Yeah. Dolphins have bigger brains than us. But that's an interesting point because there was for many, many years a thing where, you know, men have... And some neurologists still kind of believe this. Men have bigger brains and therefore they are more intelligent. And actually, intelligence has nothing to do with the size of your brain. It's the crenellations. It's how much your brain is folded.
Yeah.
And arguably, women tend to have more crenellated brains than men because you have to pack a lot more into a smaller space because we tend to be smaller.
Yeah.
So...
You hear that? Smaller people are smarter, guys. Anyway, it's why Jules is so smart.
Wow, an insult wrapped in flattery.
Did I get away with it?
Not quite, no. Yeah, before we go off on a complete tangent, ultimately, when we're talking about differences between biological differences, shall we say, biological differences on a very binary fundamental level, ultimately, the differences of degree, not kind. We're not completely separate species, no matter what that bloke who wrote men are from Mars, women are from Venus would have you think.
No. And as I said, there are averages. And that's really important to remember. There are averages. That means that you can say, you know, there are a majority of women who perhaps exhibit certain behaviours or whose brains are wired in a certain way. That does not mean that all women are lumped into that category. And that also doesn't mean that within that average, there isn't going to be a lot of variety as well.
Yeah, it's absolutely a sliding scale of humanity. And, you know, you have to then think that even with the best possible genetic combination, how you live and the environment you're born into will have a great deal of effect on how that's expressed. So... You know, that there isn't a definite for either biological sex in that respect.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so what we're saying is we don't want to leave anyone behind with this discussion. We're mostly looking from the perspective of female characters because that's the perspective we're coming from. Perhaps we'll do it again from a male perspective in the future.
Yes.
This is also going to be a really, really spoilery episode in case you guys did not get it yet. Yeah. We're not going to hold back. So any book we mention, any film we mention in this, we will talk about the ending probably and we will spoilify you. We'll put a warning tag on this episode, but it's happening.
Yeah. It's also worth mentioning that we are in no way attempting to sort of poke at the paranormal romance genre or even romance in general. You know, we've had episodes about these in the past and we know the value of these genres. And I think it's also important to recognize that some people use fiction as a type of fantasy for themselves because it is fiction. So people will read something which has, you know, very dominant male and a very submissive female, which, you know, you look at it and you'd be like, that actually seems like a kind of on the verge of being an abusive relationship. And just because someone reads that and enjoys that doesn't mean that that's what they seek out in life or even what they would approve of in life. You know, we've looked at other examples, which is, you know, the other week we talked about our villains and stuff that we liked, and I can say, yeah, I like Loki, I like it from Marvel, I like Eren from the Hamashia cycle. I wouldn't want them to be real, okay? I like them in the context of fiction, in the context of this fantasy. So we absolutely recognise that. That's not what we're going to be poking holes at. So this is not a judgement about what you read at all, or a judgement about what you happen to enjoy.
No, absolutely not. And as we've talked about in our Demon Lover episode, I think we talked about the fact that it's often a substitute for women having been conditioned a certain way for then reclaiming sexual agency or abdicating responsibility for that agency.
Yes, exactly.
So, again, we're not going to go too much into that simply because we have already covered it and, you know, we've got a lot to talk about today.
We do. We have a lot. We have a lot to unpack. There are a lot of emotions stirring up strong here. So I guess the first thing we should deal with, sorry. Is subjects which come up in things which have been labelled as feminist fantasy, and we're going to focus on fantasy, not only fantasy, but we're going to focus in on fantasy because we have a lot of examples of that. And these are things, you know, these are subjects where people say, "Ah, oh, yeah, this is feminist," and actually, it really isn't.
No, I think. Part of the problem is, I mean, looking at our first one, like the distribution of power, who's got the power, who does it come from, etc. And I think a lot of people seem to think that if you just put a female lead in, the female is the main character, they've kind of got this sort of, it was a dated notion back in the 70s and 80s, and it's really dated now, that somehow that makes a book or a film feminist. It really, really doesn't, because unless you put a female character in who is actually a female character and is allowed to be a fully formed character, then what you're doing is you're kind of adding to a great long slew of badly drawn female characters in fiction.
Yes.
I completely understand why there are some people at the moment who are saying, oh, there's this slew of female characters in fantasy who, you know, and the men are kind of like adjuncts. And yes, you're right, but do you know what? You're still kind of, we're still outnumbered in those arenas by sort of 1,000 to 1. There's been literal decades of the male main character always being, the main character always being male.
Yeah.
And the female character always being either a sexy lamp or a femme fatale or fridged.
Yes.
So we've got ground to make up, and I'm really sorry if people are finding that frustrating, but, you know, there are plenty of authors out there who are still writing male leads.
Yeah, I think the other reason that people are, and understandably, finding it frustrating is that there are people who are using it as a shortcut to say, oh, look, if we put a female lead in, that's all we need. We can tick that and say that's feminist. And no, it isn't. No, it isn't. Because also, if you put a female lead in, then all your male characters are weak. That's not feminist. If your female character is weak or the story is weak, that's not feminist. It makes me think of... because people have done that and created very sort of like shallow or unengaging kind of narratives with a female lead, because they think, oh, if it's just a female, that's it. I've just ticked that box, is that you then actually stop people having the opportunity to, or challenge people having the opportunity to create engaging narratives which do have female leads. And it makes me think of Avatar, The Legend of Korra.
Yeah.
Which I really enjoy. There were a couple of little sort of weak bits, and then they, you know, they picked it up again and it was very good, and I don't really blame the creators for that. I think there were some internal things which were happening, but I really liked The Legend of Korra, and one of the things was, originally I believe it was Nickelodeon said, you can't have a female avatar because it will ostracize the young boys, they're not going to enjoy Korra. So they put it before an audience of young boys who absolutely loved Korra. Because Korra is a dynamic and an interesting character. And her gender really doesn't come into it. Yes, her gender will absolutely, you know, play into aspects of who she is. But her gender has not been used as a character. You know, her gender isn't her character, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I think, you know, it kind of does a disservice to, you know, to boys and to men when you say that you can't enjoy something with a female lead. Because, then you get people like Mark Lawrence, who wrote the Red Sister trilogy and has gone on and written the Books of the Ice, and it's kind of like the Books of the Ancestors, sorry. And, you know, loads of men really love those, and they're female-led. In fact, most men aren't even noticing that they're female-led because the characters are so well done, as in it's kind of like, it's such an incidental thing. It's not being... it's not being shoved in anyone's face to say, this is my unique selling point. I've got a female character in the lead role.
Yeah.
Okay, so the thing with the distribution of power is that...
Sorry.
It... Madeline knows what I'm going to say. I'm going to say it anyway. the thing with distribution of power... Let's start with the word empowered. Empowered is a problematic word because it often means that someone else has doled out power to you. Mm. And it's particularly problematic in terms of saying empowered woman, because it means usually that a man has decided that a woman may have a certain amount of power in a certain area.
Yes.
So, yes, that's a personal hobby horse that I can't quite get off of. Leaving that aside, distribution of power in fantasy, you know, you might have a character who's going from very low powered to very high powered, or you might have a character who starts off with something that's so terrible they're going to accidentally destroy the world and it's learning how to control it. There's all sorts of hero's journeys you can send your main character on. The one that I don't ever want to see again is the one where the main character only becomes a fully formed person because some man comes along, sets her on the right path, gives her her power, which is never more than his, by the way, and sort of doles everything out. It sort of 50s housewife style.
Yeah.
As in, yeah, you're this person, you've got this status, this power, etc., because I have given it to you.
I feel like we do need to give the example that we're thinking of here. so we're just going to come out and say it. Now, again, I really did enjoy the Accord Thorns and Roses series. But the fact of the matter is that when you compare the relationship with Tamlin and the relationship with Rhysand, the whole thing with Feyre being the High Lady, she's the High Lady, you know, Jules.
Really? Because I don't think that ever really got mentioned in the books.
No, yeah, I don't feel like that's... I feel like that's something that we need to be told every time she's... On page,
yeah. You knew that she could. Sarah J. Maas could have got that in a few more times.
I think she probably could have. She's the High Lady. But the thing is that she's not High Lady from birth. She's High Lady because Rhysand wants her to be High Lady. She has all of her power because it was given to her by all the High Lords,
which Rhysand made happen.
She has pretty much everything she has, everything she owns, it was given to her by Rhysand. And he is still more powerful than her.
Yeah.
And one thing that really got me was that the difference between A Court of Thorns and Roses and then as you get into sort of A Court of Mist and Fury... A Mist of Court and Fury. A Court of Mist and Fury is that in the original book, Feyre actually has a lot more agency in terms of the power that she seizes.
Yes,
because
definitely.
She's the one who gets Tamlin. Tamlin gives her quite a lot of stuff. You know, he caters for her family because she has taken something from him. First of all, she killed one of his men. So he in turn takes her away and then fulfills her role for the family by giving them wealth. So that's fine. I don't really see a problem with that. I mean, you could still see a problem with that, but I'm kind of willing to let that go. Feyre sort of builds up in A Court of Thorns and Roses. She's the one who decides she's going to go and win Tamlin back. She's the one who goes under the mountain. She's the one who completes the tasks. All of the power, all of the things that she grabs with her own hands. Yes, she has a little bit of help along the way, but she grabs it with her own hands. It's not given to her.
Yeah.
Whereas in the others, even though she does do some cool stuff, and again, I really did love A Court of Mist and Fury, she learns to use the powers, and that is something which she actively does do. But again, it's all under Rhysand. Everything that Feyre is under is is because of Rhysand. And if that was all there was to it, it wouldn't be that much of a bother. As I said, I didn't really mind it that much in A Court of Mist and Fury, and I didn't even really mind it that much in A Court of Wings and Ruin, though Jules drew the line.
Yeah, don't get me started on that no. book.
So if that was all there was to it, it wouldn't really bother me. But it isn't all there is to it. It's the first thing in a long line of issues which have started to build up. And ultimately, Feyre is the main character, but Rhysand is constantly labelled as the most powerful.
Yeah, constantly. And maybe if it was just that one series, it wouldn't be as much of an issue. I mean, it would be an issue for me, but it wouldn't be such a big issue in literary terms. But it happens in every single series that she's written. Mm. So that's three separate series where you've got someone who is supposed to be kind of the best, but ultimately the reason they're the best is because some man has come along and, you know, like spotting a waitress and deciding she's destined for superstardom kind of thing.
Yeah.
But worse.
And I mean, to be honest, it's okay if you have a man who's like a mentor character, who sort of nurtures something, but ultimately there does need to be this ownership of power in some way. Then not just an ownership of power, but also a striving for one's own goals, for one's own purpose, for one's own title and stuff like that. And I think one of the other important things is that whenever you have a mentor character, what inevitably happens is that the student will outgrow the mentor. That's the entire purpose of it. They will outgrow the mentor, or they will, you know, they will take the step beyond. That's why they are the one who's the hero and not the mentor who's the hero. That doesn't ever happen in A Court of Thorns and Roses.
I find it troubling as well because it's never a case of true equality. I mean, on one hand, you've kind of got... I mean, Rhysand almost loses all his personality by the third book. Yeah. Certainly does for a little while because he sort of just becomes Feyre's love interest. But Feyre also kind of loses what made her interesting. I never liked her, but what made her interesting as well, because she's ceded any agency to this romance. And, you know, The plot suffers for it. The plot goes with it. So if you're invested in the romance, then you probably enjoyed the book. But if you're not invested in the romance and you actually wanted a fantasy novel, then, like me, you probably ended up quite disappointed.
I think the other thing is that you have this massive changeover, which was a whole Feyre's thing, was that she didn't like wearing dresses, for instance, and stuff, because it wasn't practical and stuff like that. And she was never really invested in any of those things. And you see this whole thing with her with Tamlin. He's like, why is he always trying to put me in dresses? Why is he giving me all of this jewellery and stuff like that? And it's framed as this whole, you know, he's pushing me down. And then Rhysand does the exact same thing, where you see her wearing all these dresses, which he gives her, which it turns out his mother made for his future wife, somehow knowing exactly Feyre's size.
And suddenly they're fine.
Yeah. Now, what I would have bloody well liked, actually, was rather than his mother making them, what would have been interesting for me would have been if Rhysand had been the one who'd made them. Because actually that would be quite interesting to see, like, another side to this character in a feminist way, of having him doing something which is typically seen as a woman's duty, particularly during the time. You know, doing something which would usually be womanly.
Yeah, or maybe we could have just stuck to the whole Feyre doesn't like dresses, therefore she doesn't wear dresses.
Yeah, and like, again, it's fine if she wants to occasionally wear a few dresses and stuff like that, but, like, yeah, it was just this kind of big switcheroo. And the problem is that you start off with whole Feyre's thing being, I'm not like the other girls, and then...
Oh, we're getting onto that in a bit.
We're getting onto that in a bit, but then she is like the other girls.
And what encapsulates it is basically, yeah, you're not like the other girls up until the right man comes along.
Yeah.
Which is an incredibly offensive idea.
Yeah.
Anything which demands that you subsume your entire personality.
Yeah.
like that for another person, for you know, a romantic partner of any gender is really offensive.
Yeah.
So, yes, we will get on to that in a bit.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's the distribution of power thing, which is a real issue. As a comparison,
mm-hmm.
I've talked about Tamora Pierce's The Immortals Quartet before, and, yeah, nobody go into it expecting lots of racy, smutty scenes, because they ain't there, okay? And I know a lot of people are still kind of like, ah, that relationship between Ymir and Dana is really problematic, because he's like 15 years older than her. And he does start off as a teacher. But as I've talked about before, when they get to that point, they don't just jump into bed together. You know, they have a really serious talk about it. And she's kind of like, well, you know, if it's love, then where's the harm, really? We acknowledge each other as equals. And he's like, yeah, but it's very easy for an older man to convince a younger woman that she's in love with him.
Yeah.
And it's base trickery, and I won't do it. And she said, well, yeah, okay, but one day, you know, we might progress this. And he also says, you know, and one day you might wake up and realise that you've got an old man next to you and that's not what you want.
Mm.
She's like, yeah, but you could turn that the other way around and say that, you know, you wake up one morning and what you've got is essentially someone who's just out of childhood rather than a cultured, mature woman. So, yeah, they have difficulties, and they're not just pretending that that relationship isn't fraught with peril kind of thing. So they progress very, very carefully, yeah. And it is... I don't find it problematic because, A, they're setting it in a medieval setting when girls did get married at sort of 16 mm-hmm. in the medieval era, even to men who were 25 or slightly older.
Yeah.
And because they had that conversation and they've... Oh, through the books, you see that it's two equals mm-hmm. who are coming to rely on each other. Not they've grown from mentor and student.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what you see in the A Court of Thorns and Roses books at all.
No.
As in, generally, I mean, the whole... Can we talk about the Fae aging thing? Because that's a real
Thank
problem.
Thank God you said it, because I was really confused. Like, don't say it, Madeline. Don't say it, because we're going to go off on a tangent. But thank God you've given me permission. Okay, so the Fae aging thing makes... absolutely no sense in A Court of Thorns and Roses. In the beginning, it was kind of established that because the Fae live for so long and that children are so rare and you know, difficult that... Sorry, difficult, as in it's difficult to have children in the Fae realm. Children are children for an extraordinary long period of time. So we know this because they even say that, you know, children are only sort of start to get into adulthood when they're about 75, they say.
Hmm.
So I thought, okay, so basically it's kind of a little bit like they develop three times as slowly, and we know that it's not just they mentally develop three times as slowly, they physically develop, and this is not something which sort of happens as they get older, you know, so it's not that they develop normally until they're kind of about into their adulthood and into their power, and then they start to slow down. It happens from when they're very young. We know this because you have the character of Alice, who has her two nephews who rushed in, who she saved, and they went to Tamlin about 50 years ago, and her nephews are still little boys. They must be about sort of 50 years old, which in Fae terms means that they are about kind of 11 years old, thereabouts.
Yeah.
So fine, absolutely fine. That makes sense to me. It also makes sense because then you see characters like Rhysand and stuff like that, and you say, okay, so actually they are quite young. They're quite young. I mean, he's still getting on a little bit because he's like over 500 years old. But anyway, I think, you know, past a certain point, they just continue to stay young, and it takes them a long time to sort of get older. So I don't know. Maybe he looks like he's in his 30s. I'm not sure. It does start to disintegrate a little bit, because then apparently you can see older looking Fae, and I'm like, well, how old do they have to be? But regardless, let's put that to the side. That kind of made sense to me. I was like, yeah, totally, 100% can see that, no problem at all. And then in the recent novel, suddenly there's talk of them being like 16 and out drinking, and I'm like, 16? 16? If we use that in fae play terms. They must have been about 3 years old. What the hell are they doing? Like, oh yeah, they were out training when they were out and they were training and they were drinking and they were having sex. And I was like, what? No, that doesn't make sense. They were meant to be children. And it's completely switched around. And I think the reason this sort of happened was that you then have other characters who are introduced. The people who make friends with Nesta and stuff like that, who are only meant to be 25. Which again, in Fae terms, should mean that they are about 5 years old.
Yeah, they're basically children. It's like the whole sort of, at the beginning of the series, Fae is 19.
Mm-hmm.
You get to the beginning of A Call to Silver Flames and Nesta's about 25.
Yeah.
And yet for some reason, and she does this with Crescent City as well, she does this with the Assassin books, as in you will have this young woman who is sort of 19 to 20 and ending up hooking up with someone who is several hundred years old. And you can't do that and then tell me that, and then sort of get funny about an age gap of 15 years. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And this is the thing that really gets me. Because if we think of Fae aging in terms of the fact that they develop three times slower. So if we think of it like that, then the age gap doesn't actually make a difference, because in terms of development, you know, they have that they're still on an equal kind of par. Now, not so much with Rhysand, probably more with Tamlin, because developmentally, Tamlin is just only a little bit older than Feyre, because he's actually quite young.
Yeah.
Rhysand is significantly older, but that's fine. If we think of it in terms of how they've developed, if we just think of it as slowing down, then that kind of makes sense. And, you know, this is a rule that I've put into the Hamartia cycle, in that the more magic you use, the more your kind of your development slows down, both physically and mentally, because it's like your whole biology just slows down. Which is why you get people, the Magi, who age relatively normally, then they start to get to the academy and they start to kind of, they age a little bit slower. And then by the time they get to Magi and they're using major magics, their aging suddenly becomes three times as slow. So they stay behaving like 19-year-olds for an incredibly long period of time, which is why they're considered to be, you know, so troublesome. That kind of makes sense. At least I think it makes sense. So it made sense in A Court of Thorns and Roses. But the problem then, if you say, no, that's not the case, if you say they develop like normal human beings in that, you know, that 16, they're like 16-year-olds and stuff like that, and then it's just that they continue to look younger, and then they just continue on with their years, suddenly, in terms of development, we're not looking at someone who is the equivalent age of Feyre, or the equivalent age of Nesta, we're looking at someone who is significantly older in terms of, you know, development, mental and physical. So even if physically they look young, mentally they should be a lot older, which they absolutely don't behave like.
No, they don't. They behave like, at best, people in their very early 20s. Immature people in their very early 20s as well.
Yes. Which, again, you could understand if they basically said, okay, yes, the development when you're young is slow and then it continues to get slower. That makes sense. That makes sense. Except she's changed the rules. And so it no longer makes sense. And so it's weird. Sorry.
That's okay. Looping it back around, just so that it's connected to the whole balance of power thing. An age gap does not automatically confer more power on the older person. Sometimes it can be the other way around. In real life as well as in fiction. And sometimes it doesn't confer a balance of power either way. Sometimes it is genuinely just an equal relationship. So people need to stop getting their knickers in a knot about this sort of thing.
Yeah, and by the way, we're not talking about paedophilia here. We're not talking about a child and an adult.
No.
We're talking about two adults who have an age gap between them.
Yeah, so over 18, fine. Over 21 in some cases, if you know you're American. But ultimately, you've got to wonder, there is definitely a world building issue there in the sense of what could someone who is 500 and genuinely has developed through those years to be 500 years old possibly find of interest to say to someone who is 21? It's yes. Like, it doesn't, that makes no sense. That's not kind of like, yeah, we've been through hell together. There just happens to be a 15-year age gap, but you know what? I can trust you more than anyone else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
This is, that's fucking weird. Okay. Before yeah. we then look at the fact that there is a genuine magical imbalance of power as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also there's this sense of it being a running theme. And this is the bit that gets me, because I think it is more than possible for two people who have an age gap between them. And I'm not talking about men much older than women. I'm talking the other way around. You know, I know people who have 15-year age gap between them. And the woman is the one who's older and the man is the one who's younger. She was previously married. They got together and they continue to be very happily married. So, you know, I know that these things are possible and that it can be an incredibly healthy relationship. Again, I must stress, between two consenting adults. And it is possible, but that's down to the individual. What starts to be strange is when you have older people continuously targeting younger people, continuously only dating people who are younger, purposefully looking at people who are younger, rather than it being about the individual. It's a serial thing. Now, we don't really see that much of Rhysand's other behaviour or his other dating, things like that. So we don't know whether he's, you know, serial, you know, he's been continually sleeping around with people who are a lot younger than him. But we don't have to, because Sarah J. Maas's, all of her male characters are all dating women who aren't just, you know, 10 years younger than them. They're centuries younger than them.
Yeah.
And that's a trend. That's a trend which she particularly likes. And again, I don't actually have a problem with the story arc of, okay, he's a, you know, he's an immortal vampire or something like that, and she's a girl. Because usually there's that frozen in time kind of concept. You know, that's what worked in Twilight, is that they were 17, but they were continuously 17. It's not that he was 117, that was only in years. He was still mentally, physically, consistently, emotionally 17 years old.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's where I start to get the thing, because it's not just one storyline, it's all three of the storylines that she's presented, and that's what worries me.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, moving on to some of the other things that we've got on our list. I was about to say this one really, really bugs me, but actually all of these really bug me, so just take that as read as I go through them.
Yeah.
The female main character's role is reduced to that of love interest, sometimes even within her own story arc.
Yes.
So this is never more apparent than, say, for example, in the second Avengers film, when Black Widow suddenly becomes a love interest of the Hulk and Bruce Banner. And she is they're playing off the fairy tale, the idea that, you know, the beauty can soothe the savage beast kind of thing. Which, yeah. Yes, okay, it's definitely got lineage in terms of story ideas, but on the other hand, was really, really offensive. I mean, she is literally the most competent Avenger out of all of them.
Yeah.
She's the one who consistently gets shit done, and yet you've benched her to be some sort of zookeeper for the Hulk. So that's already really, really offensive.
Yeah.
And I've heard the arguments to say that, you know, well, what do you do with her character? And I'm like, you could do anything with her character. She's like 80 years old. She was part of the same super soldier program as the Winter Soldier and yeah. Captain America. There's a lot of really, really interesting stuff that you could have her do. But no, because you're continually focusing on this very stereotypically masculine set of movie pyrotechnics, if you like, mm-hmm. action pyrotechnics, you're not looking at character interaction. It you know, it's just really embarrassing. And I think it was kind of a, also, this is a Joss Whedon thing, he directed that film. You know, we've got a really strong female character, we have to show the vulnerable side. You can show a vulnerable side without making her just a love interest.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And this also applies to male characters as well. Male characters who've just been kind of put to the side as the love interest. Also particularly, I think it's worth noting, you can never seem to have characters then who were the side characters who are not a love interest. One of the things, and I know lots of people didn't really, had lots of issues with Agent Carter, particularly because it kind of, you know, it hinted at more diversity than it ever then produced. One of the things I really, really liked about Agent Carter was that obviously you had Peggy Carter, and the second main character was, of course, Jarvis.
Yeah.
And neither of them were love interests for one another. Jarvis was married. Peggy was obviously still very much in love with Steve, and then she kind of had her own thing going on with other characters. Now, I really liked that, because here we have two characters who are nuanced and who are friends. They are friends with one another, and one of them hasn't therefore been relegated to, right, I'm just the love interest now. So that's one example of something I like, but so often, you think you have this character, right, we're going to have to put them in as a love interest. That's all they can be relegated to. And again, going back to A Court of Thorns and Roses, I swear that in book three of A Court of Thorns and Roses, A Court of Wings and Ruin, Rhysand did just kind of become a love interest. He didn't really have any character at
all. To be honest, I think so did Feyre, which was just really weird.
Yeah, they were both just love interests for the other, and it was very peculiar.
And again, this is a repeating theme in Mass's books, because the same thing kind of happened in the most recent one.
Yeah.
As well. And it's just, I don't know. I think, just as a sidebar, part of the problem is Sarah J. Maas now wants to write smutty romance. So she should go and write smutty romance. But what sells is her fae books with smut in them.
Yeah.
And she's bending characters out of true in their arcs to do that. And that's cheating the reader. So yes, you'll make money in the short term, but in the long term you will lose readers.
Yes. At the same time, a lot of people seem to actually really, really be enjoying the smutty side of things, which I find funny, because I was just very uncomfortable with most of the sex scenes she wrote.
We will talk about the smutty.
We'll talk about the smutty. Yes. But yeah, absolutely. It's just a strange thing, because I should also point out that it's okay if you have romance between the two main characters and they're a man and a woman, or two men or two women, or etc. It doesn't really matter. That's not what we're talking about. There's a difference between being sort of two people having a romance and being relegated to the role of the love interest.
As in, oh god, we've got one token female character and we don't know what to do with her. And that was very much what happened with Black Widow in that film.
Yep.
Because yes, you have Scarlet Witch, but she's not technically part of the group yet. Mm. And lo and behold, when you get into later Avengers films, Scarlet Witch, arguably one of the most powerful Avengers, suddenly becomes a love interest for Vision. Which, you know, I love that pairing. I genuinely do. Yep. But at the same time, there was so much more you could have done with both of those characters.
Yeah.
So yes, that was a slight issue for me. Okay, I'm pretty sure this is one of Madeline's big, big bugbears. And that is the not like other girls trope. This is a tricky one, because, you know what, this is something that I think I personally internalised a lot through my own childhood, because I resisted all things traditionally feminine, simply because I didn't like them. That didn't mean I thought that they were rubbish, But I was made to feel like I was rubbish because I did not want to embrace them. I was made to feel like I wasn't human incorrectly because I wasn't girl incorrectly. So in some respects, I can understand the sort of defensive, I only get on with boys better, I don't really get on with girls kind of mm-hmm. thing, because that's what it was like being a child and being a teenager. And then, God, thankfully, you get to university and you realise that actually there's loads of really, really sane people out there who don't just want to put you in little boxes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's been a work of deprogramming, because things creep into your own writing through this.
Yes.
And it's like Madeline's thing of you found female characters boring for a while.
Yes, and to be honest, I still suffer from that. But one thing that I kind of realised was that I kind of did a full 100, not a full 180, a full 360, which was that I wouldn't engage with a lot of female characters whenever I picked up books or movies. And then I said to myself, this is internalised misogyny. You're only doing this because you've been told to think of sort of female things as bad, which means that you can't really engage with them and stuff like that. And then I kind of came back around and I said, no, actually, the reason I'm not engaging with these female characters is because they're badly written. They're not interesting. Because I can absolutely still engage with a female character who is not like me, in the same way that I can engage with a male character who is not like me. And I looked around and I said, no, I know that I have preferences of character. But the problem isn't that my preferences of character is that they have to be male. It's that I like certain type of archetypes, which are almost exclusively put to male characters. And I dislike other archetypes, which are almost always exclusively put to female characters. And those archetypes are the incredibly bossy person, which is almost always put to the female character. The other one is the total rejection of anything feminine, or to the point of cruelty. I don't like characters who are just mean constantly.
Yeah.
Which is again what you would get, is that you'd have these characters, particularly these female characters who were mean, and that was their entire character arc. They couldn't ever be seen having fun. They could never seen be having enjoying stuff like that. They could only be mean and bitchy and stuff like that. And they were so often put forward as this very, oh, look at this feminist character, she don't need no man. And I'm like, yeah, but apparently she doesn't need anyone. And also, she's really nasty to other people. I don't like those characters. And those were the characters which were being presented. And also I recognise that there are still some archetypes people do enjoy and they like them, and that's absolutely fine. But the thing that really annoys me is that it's not like the other girls, because there's nothing wrong with the other girls. It's also this understanding that all girls, that there's some kind of club which all girls are part of, and there are a few strange outliers.
Yeah.
No, it's nuanced. People are nuanced. It's not that 9 out of 10 people, you know, 9 out of 10 girls all enjoy, you know, painting their nails and going to the salon, and, you know, which are all actually kind of nice things to do, but, you know, all enjoy doing those kinds of things, and all these typically sort of girly things are going shopping and all that stuff. Because, yeah, there are absolutely girls who do that, and those are the same girls who then also enjoy doing other things as well. It's this idea that there's one dimension. You're either that one dimension, or you're actually a girl who's trying to be I'm not talking about being trans. There's a girl who's taking all of these typically one-dimensional male qualities and stuffing them in, but then they're quietly unfulfilled because actually that hard exterior isn't quite right, and actually there's something small and gooey underneath, and the male love interest needs to sort of drill through it, and then he'll find that actually, no, deep underneath she's kind of sweet. It's one of the things I liked in The Chosen Ones by Veronica Roth, is that you've got Sloane, who everyone's like, you know, underneath it all she's a teddy bear, and she's like, no, I'm not, I really am just this person.
It's like, no, what you see is what you get. I think that was the thing. I was always a what you see is what you get person as well. And that meant that I was always one of those weird mystical outliers, which was not necessarily fun, because if I was willing to take people at face value, then I felt that I should be receiving that in return, which apparently was asking too much of people. Things obviously changed between my childhood and Madeline slightly. So we ended up with different sets of selection pressures in terms of being a girl.
Yes.
But seeing it creep into fiction is just so incredibly depressing. So, I mean, you can tell, because if you look at something with a female lead, then look at how few female friends they have. And look at how other women react to them. Look at their disregard for other women or scorn for feminine things.
Yeah, and also look at actually the friendship that they do have with females as well.
Yeah, definitely. And there is usually men swarming all over them, and quite often they are competing for men with the other girls.
Yes.
So there's a, I don't know, it's a toxic knot of horrible tropes right there. It's something I don't really want to see in fiction anymore, and I have to say I've seen it in every single one of S.J. Maas's books so far. It's very depressing.
Okay. Before we get on too long, because I'm still bursting, let's move on to the next one. So yeah, there's lots to unpack, definitely, with the not like the other girls thing, which I think, to be honest, could be an entire episode of just me ranting. So we will move on. We'll move on to our last point, because, well, Jules, honestly, this is going to have to be a two-parter, because there's just too much. There's too much for us to unpack, Jules.
There's too much. We have too much to say. We have too many opinions.
Too many opinions. What a surprise. So I think the last one that I want to pick up on is other female characters hate the main character.
Yeah, and see, that's a tricky one. I've seen people really slag off any book that has any female character hating another female character. And you know what? Girl-on-girl hate does happen. But when that's all there is, when there's no variation, when it's... I think the problem is it becomes very stereotypical, doesn't it? And instead of having, these are nuanced people who don't get on, you then end up with, there's a pack of mean girls and our poor, unprotected little mean character who is not like the other girls, TM. And it's just really embarrassing.
Yeah, absolutely. It also... Look, girls can be catty with one another. Particularly in school, female bullies can be the worst.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's inaccurate to have, like, a group of female bullies or things like that. What gets me is that you get this continuous narrative of us versus them, which again really adds to this sense of the binary, and that particularly when you have a female character who displays typically male qualities or things like that. And then the people who they're up against are all the same. They're not nuanced in any way. Now, Mean Girls, I feel like Mean Girls is an interesting one because we're giving an example, we're using that as an example of when it happens, but actually I think Mean Girls, they were quite nuanced with each of the individual
and
characters.
And the way they took the entire plot journey from the, you know, we're desperately competing with each other and we have a very acrid set of mean girls. Mostly because all of them are really insecure teenagers. And then taking it right through to the end of the film where everyone kind of finds their niche and they've got a bit more balance and everyone's a bit more level and they can see it happening in younger generations.
Mm.
It was really, really clever.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that they did it very well. And obviously that is also meant to be a school. But I really like female friendships. And I also like nuance as well in terms of why does one character hate the other character? Because usually there's a reason. There's a reason people dislike other people. And particularly when you have this, you know, all the female characters hate the MC. Why? Why do they hate them? Is it jealousy? Is it a difference of opinions? You know, do they differ in terms of how they think people should be taxed? Why do they hate them? And so often it's just kind of, jealousy is one of the ones that really gets me, and it's usually jealousy over she got the man and I didn't.
Or
I want that
or
man.
Or she was prettier kind of thing. And that opens another toxic can of worms, because it's kind of the MC nearly always isn't aware of her own attraction and nearly always sort of is supposed to be sort of the most attractive person in the room, but isn't aware of it, which, you know, it can happen, but it's pretty rare for people not to have any clue whatsoever. And she's always naturally pretty. She's never made any effort with her own appearance.
Yeah, that's the thing that also really gets me is you have said, oh, they're a natural beauty, and that's seen as the thing of virtue. Someone who makes an effort with the way they look is seen as being vain and stuff like that, and that's always the case with the other girls. Oh, look, I've made such an effort to look nice, and she just waltzes in all natural beauty and steals things away from me, having made no effort at all. I really dislike that. I really, really dislike that, because also I think it's possible that people can just be pretty. Also, why do the main characters always have to be conventionally pretty? And why is there always this weird obsession with emaciation as well? It just all comes in. And yeah, I suppose it's meant to sort of tie in with the concept of the underdog, which is also you have the mean girls are always the very rich, very popular, looking down on someone else because they're a servant or they're a lower class or they don't have as much money or they don't have the same fashions, etc., 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 which again does happen in school.
Yeah.
But
it's that Cinderella trope, isn't it?
It is. I just think that there's other ways that it can be explored, and there's ways that it can be done well. I do think they did it well in Mean Girls, but I also think that it's a bit tiring, really.
Yeah, it can get very tiring. And you can absolutely have someone who is not aware that they are, like, conventionally attractive. Particularly if they've grown up in circumstances where they're continually being pushed down and told that they're less than everybody else. You know, it absolutely can happen. But most of the time, people know that they don't look like the back end of a bus because they've actually put a bit of work in on it.
Yeah. It's actually also one of the things I really like about in Cinderella as well, is that Cinderella, she's not completely unaware of how she looks. She puts on a nice dress and she's like, wow, I look great. You know, she's happy with her nice dress. She's aware of the fact that she's made an effort to look nice.
Yeah.
And yet people have sort of, like, forgotten
that. It's like, it's something that I've tried to do with Harker and Blackthorne. I mean, everybody acknowledges that Bex is absolutely gorgeous. And she is really, really, really attractive. And she's aware of it. She doesn't care that much about appearances. So she's not spending a lot of time on it. But at the same time, whenever she's ever challenged on it, it's like Amy saying, you do realise you just look like the beautiful heroine of an action film who's just survived worse than death. And Beck's like, yeah, it's good genes. And Amy's like, I fucking hate you. But it's kind of played off for laughs, as in, this is the hand you were dealt. That doesn't mean that everybody else in the room is, like, way less attractive than you just because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I also think... It makes me think of the way, well, obviously the way that I did Kestrel, is that Kestrel knows she's not an ugly person, but she's rather average looking. If she puts in an effort, she can look nice, you know, if she does her hair nicely, if she wears nice clothes, if she's feeling confident, she's not ugly. She knows she's not ugly. But she is surrounded by supernaturally attractive people.
Literally supernaturally attractive as well.
Literally supernaturally attractive people. There's a running joke, which is that there's at one point where she's talking to her father and she's like, how did you know that Galahad was supernatural? And her father's just there like, well, I mean, look at him. It's kind of obvious. And she's like, yeah, because she made the exact same point, which was that you can tell someone who's supernatural from far off because they look way too good.
Too good to be true. So, yeah, the whole sort of all other women hate the main character is kind of an issue. I mean, if everyone else hated the main character because they actually turned out to be sort of a megalomaniac witch queen who was like killing thousands and thousands of people. That's a good reason.
Excellent reason. Excellent reason to hate the main character.
But if it's just a case of, oh, her hair curls naturally, then no, okay? That's not good enough. Right, we are going to leave it here for part one, but that doesn't mean you don't get a Dissecting Dragons recommendation this week. You absolutely do.
Yes, you do.
In between, obviously, we're very interested to hear your tropes. Perhaps we'll cover some of them in part two.
Yes, do get in touch with us. Let us know. Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Remember, you can get in contact with us via our Facebook, Tumblr, or Twitter, both individually or through the Dissecting Dragons page. We really do love hearing from you, so do get in touch. For this week's recommendation, I'm actually going to recommend something which is not new. In fact, it's ancient. Now, you guys will have heard me talk about The Journey to the West before. I've been obsessed with it since I was in primary school. I've always really enjoyed it. And some of you may know characters like the Monkey King. For example, anyone who's ever seen Dragon Ball Z will know that Son Goku is obviously based off of the Monkey King. Now, recently I got hold of a translation of Journey to the West, done by Penguin Classics, and it's a translation by a guy named Arthur Wally. I think it's Wally or Wally. And I've been reading it, and it's fantastic. They've really translated it beautifully, and what they've done is that Journey to the West is so inconceivably long that most translations, what they'll try and do is they'll try and cover all of it but then cut out a lot of the kind of the interactions and the dialogue and the poetry and stuff like that so that they can cover all of the events, which can actually make reading Journey to the West quite turgid and difficult. The Penguin Classic one, however, has done the opposite. Well, what it's done is that it's selected a few of the important stories within it, because Journey to the West is basically, it's almost like an anthology. They have a continuous, it's very episodic. They have lots and lots of episodes, lots and lots of battles and stuff like that. And Arthur Wally has basically picked up on a few of the really, really great ones, and has then kept all of this character interaction, the humour, the poetry, and translated it really beautifully. And I have just re-fallen in love with the whole thing. It's brilliant. It's a very enjoyable read. It's not a long book either, I should point out. I mean, the full thing is only about 351 pages. And that's, you know, paperback pages as well. It's actually quite a quick read. As I said, it's episodic, so you can read one chapter at a time and kind of be done with it. Highly recommended if you were curious about Journey to the West and had no idea how to start. Check out Monkey, which is one of the Penguin Classics.
That sounds amazing. I'm going to have to look for that.
Definitely. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.